Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he has determined that atrocities committed by the Islamic State group constitute genocide. Mr. Kerry made an announcement earlier today.
Daesh is genocidal by self-proclamation, by ideology, and by actions, in what it says, what it believes, and what it does. Daesh is also responsible for crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing directed at these same groups, and in some cases also against Sunni Muslims, Kurds, and other minorities.
Mr. Kerry spoke on the March 17th congressional deadline for the Obama administration to make a decision regarding atrocities committed by the Islamic State group against religious and ethnic minorities in Iraq and Syria. The latest flare-up of Ebola in Sierra Leone has ended with no confirmed cases of the virus now in West Africa, according to the UN Thursday. The World Health Organization joins the government of Sierra Leone in marking the end of the recent flare-up of the Ebola virus in the country, as according to a UN statement. The global health body made the announcement 42 days since Sierra Leone's last Ebola patient tested negative for the second time. Russian President Vladimir Putin says even his troop withdrawal from the Syrian war front, he could, if necessary, within several hours, ramp up Moscow's military presence there again. As he decorated officers who served in Syria, Putin says he does not want to escalate the conflict again and expressed hope for the common sense of Syrian authorities and opposition groups fighting President Bashar al-Assad to reach a peace accord. You're listening to VOA News. South Africa's sports minister denied Thursday that bribes were paid to win the right to host the 2010 World Cup. It comes as FIFA seeks to claw back money from officials facing graft charges in the United States. Football's world governing body this week issued a wide-ranging acknowledgement of what it called brazen corruption and demand for victim restitution made to U.S. authorities. The claim to the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York said a $10 million bribe was paid from South Africa to get votes for the country's World Cup bid, but FIFA backed away from directly accusing South Africa of bribery. The White House says President Obama will deliver an address to the Cuban people Tuesday at the end of a historic visit next week to the communist-ruled nation. Officials say it will lay out a vision of greater freedoms and economic opportunity. Ted Henkin is a Cuba analyst at Broad College in New York.
Communicate directly to the people that our policy is really built around empowerment, prosperity, not poverty, engagement, not isolation. And while we will and we are making diplomatic connections and strides with the government, we also intend to continue to respectfully and diplomatically but forcefully stand up for American values of human rights, democracy.
Mr. Obama's trip begins on Sunday, and it will be the first by a sitting U.S. president in nearly 90 years. EU leaders are expected to seal a final deal with Turkey on migrants at a two-day summit in Brussels Thursday and Friday. On the agenda is a controversial plan to send tens of thousands of migrants back to Turkey to relieve the strain on resources of countries on the eastern edge of the European Union. For every undocumented migrant that Turkey accepts, the EU says it will accept one Syrian refugee from Turkey. The EU says it will take up to a total of 70,000 refugees who will then be resettled in Europe. Two Palestinians stabbed an Israeli soldier near a Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank Thursday before being shot dead, according to the army. The incident occurred at the Ariel Junction in the West Bank. The female soldier was being taken to the hospital while the two assailants were shot by forces at the scene, according to the Israeli army. Medics described the victim's condition as moderate to severe and said she was about 20 years old. A radical Kurdish group, the Kurdistan Freedom Falcons, Thursday claimed responsibility for the suicide car bomb attack that killed 35 people in Ankara last weekend. That group has ties to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party. The claim by the attack came as Germany closed diplomatic missions in a school in Turkey Thursday over security concerns. You can read more details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
As European leaders gather for a two-day summit in Brussels, doubts are mounting they will be able to reach agreement on a deal with Turkey to curb the tide of migrants arriving on their shores.
That's Alicia Bryant reporting from Paris. Details coming up.
Also, five Egyptian soldiers are reported dead after explosions at a weapons depot in northern Sinai. And Kenya's military kills 19 al-Shabaab militants in southern Somalia.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, five Egyptian soldiers are reported dead and 10 others injured after explosions at a weapons depot in the northern Sinai. The Associated Press quotes security and medical officials as saying militants linked to Islamic State attacked the depot in the town of Rafah early today. It says militants are launching attacks against Egyptian soldiers and police in the Sinai nearly every day. In other news on Egypt, the brother of al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Sawahiri has been released from prison. The French news agency says Mohamed al-Sawahiri was released today after spending 2.5 years in prison. His son and security officials confirmed the release. Mohamed al-Sawahiri had been accused of forming a terrorist group linked to al-Qaeda. An Egyptian court had ordered his release February 23rd. And Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi is warning Italy not to lead a military intervention in Libya. He says Libya could become another Somalia or Afghanistan. The leader's comments appeared in an interview with the Rome-based daily newspaper La Repubblica. Italian Premier Matteo Renzi says Italy would only use its armed forces to help stabilize the country if it were invited to do so by a solid, internationally recognized government.
The Associated Press says Kenya's military has killed 19 al-Shabaab militants. The incident took place Tuesday night in Afmadaw, the second largest city in southern Somalia, about 150 kilometers from Kismayo. A spokesman for the Kenyan military says Kenyan troops on patrol came across the Islamic fighters who were suspected of planning to attack a Somali military camp. Kenya and six other countries contribute troops to an African Union mission in Somalia that helps provide security and protects the government.
Ghana's government has put the nation on high alert in the wake of Sunday's deadly terror attack in neighboring Ivory Coast. Francisca Kakra Forsen reports from Accra.
Ghana's national security chiefs say they have intelligence of a credible terrorist threat in the country. They made the announcement on Wednesday following a meeting with Ghana's President John Mahama to review their readiness. In a statement, the government called on Ghanaians to pay attention and report anything unusual to security agencies. The terror alert is a first for the West African country. Since November, al-Qaeda militants have attacked hotels in two other regional capitals, Bamako and Ouagadougou, and a beach resort outside Abidjan. Despite the government assurances, many here wonder, is Ghana next? And how prepared are we?
We have a very porous set of borders, and it's not properly policed. Mm-hmm. There are lots of unapproved rules. I think that we should have been proactive. But this is the disconnect I worry about.
No, this is not the first time. It's serious, but it's not worrying me. Probably it's not worrying me till it happens.
We should look at our movements. If you have nothing to do in certain areas, don't go there. If you're a terrorist and you hear Ghanaians are really aware, they are preparing, you know, to combat anybody who comes into their land, then obviously you also want to hold back.
The United Kingdom has advised its citizens in Ghana to be cautious. And on Wednesday, the U.S. military restricted travel by its service members to Ghana and four other West African countries. Francisca Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
death toll has risen from yesterday's suicide bombing at a mosque in the northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri. AFP reports the National Emergency Management Agency says the death toll now stands at 25, three more than was announced yesterday. The toll does not include the two female suicide bombers who were also killed. The women, disguised as men, attacked the Molai district of Maiduguri, which is actually the birthplace of Boko Haram militants. The group now frequently uses girls and women as suicide bombers and is believed responsible for yesterday's attack. Since Boko Haram began its insurgency in 2009, about 17,000 people have been killed.
Zanzibar is preparing for an election rerun Sunday after polls were nullified in the region last year. But the main opposition party is urging a boycott, and problems with ballot papers are causing many to wonder how a rerun will result in a better electoral process. From Nairobi, Jill Craig reports.
Lining the streets of Kampala, blue and yellow campaign posters compete for space on billboards, walls, and T-shirts. Blue represents the Forum for Democratic Change Party of main opposition candidate Kizza Besigye, while yellow is synonymous with the National Resistance Movement Party of incumbent Yoweri Museveni. The two men are the top contenders competing for Uganda's presidency, along with six other candidates. The candidate considered to be in third place is Amama Mbabazi, a former prime minister to Museveni, who is running as an independent. Joenta Sitenda is a 40-year-old Kampala resident who says she remembers life in the 1980s, when the Ugandan Bush War engulfed her country. For her, peace and stability are most important in how she votes.
NRM, I like it. It's my party. It has given us peace. Yeah, we've been able to get skills. It has enlightened us in a lot of things.
Peace is a common refrain cited by those supporting the NRM. Older supporters remember war and do not want a return of conflict, while younger ones, like Isaac Dungu, are influenced by the experiences of their elders.
My father was in prison, of the previous president, Obote. So when Museveni came into power, he released him from prison. So all our family is a supporter of President Museveni.
But other voters, especially younger ones, say they are more concerned with how their country is faring in terms of more current issues, like health care, education, and employment. And Uganda's youth are a difficult-to-ignore demographic. Out of a population of about 38 million people, 50% of the population is under the age of 16, and another 25% is between the ages of 16 and 30. Lamla Muhindo is a young FDC supporter who is frustrated by what she says are a lack of opportunities in Uganda. She says, "We have a job problem. There are no jobs. I am working at a building, as a painter, as a builder, but I am not destined to work there because I've got some qualifications. I can work somewhere in the office. So maybe when President Besigye comes into power, I can get a chance." FDC supporter Abe Seguja says it is time for 71-year-old Museveni to step down as president after his 30 years in office and enjoy his golden years. He says, "We are ready to take care of President Museveni so he can sit back and relax at his home. We will take the juices, we will take the fruit to his house. Let him rest because he's a grandpa now. He's very old for the nation." On Monday, Besigye was on his way to a rally when police stopped his convoy and detained him, saying he was conducting rallies in the off-limits central business district. Besigye was released that afternoon, but supporters got into altercations with police as they waited near Makerere University for their candidate to continue his campaign. Supporters threw stones and police fired tear gas into the crowd. Both candidates finished their campaigns on Tuesday, as thousands of Ugandans came out to support them at various rallies around Kampala. Besigye has run against Museveni three times before, losing each time amid accusations that the president's supporters rigged the vote and intimidated his opponents. Polls open at 7 a.m. local time on Thursday and close at 4 p.m. Jill Craig, VOA News, Kampala.
15 past the hour. You are listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. It was a busy day for rescuing migrants and refugees on the Mediterranean. Reuters reports more than 2,400 people were rescued in the Strait of Sicily today, while on the Aegean, the Turkish Coast Guard intercepted a boat heading for the Greek islands. It was carrying dozens of Afghans. Meanwhile, as European Union leaders gather for a two-day summit in Brussels, doubts are mounting. They will be able to reach agreement on a deal with Turkey to curb the tide of migrants arriving on their shores. Lisa Bryan has more from Paris.
Even before the talks started in Brussels, European Council President Donald Tusk struck a negative note, saying he was more cautious than optimistic they would succeed. He said any migrant deal with Turkey must be based on three fundamental principles.
First, the agreement must be acceptable to all 28 member states, no matter big or small. Second, the agreement must fully comply with EU and international law. And third, the agreement must effectively help to solve the migration crisis and contribute to our comprehensive strategy, which includes getting back to Schengen, ending the way through policy, humanitarian assistance to Greece, support to the Western Balkans, and, of course, the reinforced cooperation with Turkey.
EU leaders are discussing a draft proposal that sees Turkey taking back tens of thousands of asylum seekers now in Europe in exchange for more aid, visa-free travel for Turkish citizens, and accelerated EU membership talks. The draft deal faces plenty of resistance, from legal and rights concerns to threats by EU member Cyprus to block it. As the nations confront Europe's largest refugee crisis since World War II, the pressure is on for European leaders to stop bickering and solve the problem. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, whose country has taken in the majority of asylum seekers, calls the draft deal the first real chance to stem the migration flow. EU Migration Minister Dimitris Avramopoulos described visiting Greece's rain-soaked border camp of Idomeni. Thousands are unable to move onward to Germany since Macedonia closed its frontier, and they distrust Greek reception centers.
The conditions are awful. I could never imagine that I would leave such a situation on European soil.
He said Europe was bound by international conventions to help the migrants. It must now show what he calls its human and civilized face. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Thank you, Lisa. Also today at the Greek-Macedonian border, about 12,000 migrants and refugees remain stranded in muddy and often unsanitary conditions. It's rained a lot there in recent days. There are health concerns and long queues of people waiting for food. Reporter Philippe Warwick has been following developments in the Greek town of Idomeni. He told VOA's Joe DiCapua that there was literally a ray of sunshine today at the border.
The sun has finally decided to show its face, has come out, but you still have patches of mud and waterlogged areas. I'm now actually standing right in the middle of a Greek field surrounded by tents. In front of me, there's actually MSF, Doctors Without Borders, clearing an area to build a series of large tents. So basically what they're planning to do is to actually move people from their tents in the muddy field to larger tents. And these tents are actually built on firmer ground, have firmer foundations, so there'll be a less likelihood of them being waterlogged.
Philip, you had described conditions earlier as being extremely muddy. They were worried about disease. There were long lines for food. Has any of that improved?
In terms of long lines of food, that still is the case. International NGOs are trying their best and they're doing what they can in terms of providing food. You do have also local NGOs, Greek and locals, actually, local people from local villages are bringing food, but it's still not enough to cater the 12,000 people who are in the Idomeni refugee camp. In terms of diseases, because we talked about waterborne diseases, there hasn't been an outbreak, but you still hear people, mothers, men, women, children coughing. So there is either a cold or a virus or flu in the camp, and it hasn't let go as of yet.
Do the migrants and refugees understand that that border with Macedonia probably is not going to open anytime soon?
Well, talking to the refugees over the last couple of days, some of them, not the majority, but some of them do place a great deal of hope with regard to today's summit meeting between EU and Turkey. There are those who have heard that the relocation program, with the help of the UN, the refugees having been relocated to other EU countries is a very long and cumbersome process. And the camps are in and around Athens are starting to fill up. So what they hear is that, one, okay, we do get food here. Two, the camps are in and around Athens and Greece are starting to fill up, so there's no point leaving the camp in the first place. The talks which are going to take place today, that's another issue. And then on top of that, those nationalities that cannot cross the border, they're banking on getting the help of smugglers in order to cross the border, the Greek-Macedonian border.
Philip, within the last week, we had heard that hundreds of migrants and refugees had left Idomeni and made their way to a different point along the Macedonian border and crossed into Macedonia by fording a swollen river or stream. Was that the case? And if so, what happened?
That indeed was the case. There have been actually many rumors in terms of why the 1,500 made their way. What had actually happened Sunday evening, that is that there were leaflets that were printed in Arabic, distributed among the refugees, giving them information of an alternative path. This path was actually through the Greek muddy fields and through this very dangerous river. That river had strong current and was swollen from Sunday to Monday. They were followed, they were shadowed by Macedonian police along the border, and when they did reach that gap, it was actually through a gap in the fence where the river crosses the fence. That's where they made their crossing. They were met by Macedonian police. The journalists were arrested and then later released and fined. Since there were so many thousands of refugees, the Macedonians weren't able to return them back across the border, so they transported them back in army vehicles at 100 of a time. So that operation took all night. Another thing is that Monday morning I did come across men that appeared to be beaten, that appeared to be shaken. And what they told me, what they claimed, was that overnight they had been beaten by Macedonian police prior to their deportation.
That's reporter Philippe Warwick in the Greek town of Idomeni. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Kenya is on high alert for yellow fever after a patient who recently visited Angola died while receiving treatment. Angola is battling a yellow fever outbreak that has killed dozens of people. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Kenya has reported its first case of yellow fever in 25 years. The deceased is thought to have arrived 5 days ago from Angola, a country that is fighting to stop the outbreak of the disease. The acting director of the Kenya Medical Service, Dr. Jackson Kioko, says the patient was diagnosed with the virus at an advanced stage.
We screened him and we found out that he had the yellow fever virus. And, of course, he had presented to us in very advanced stages when he had renal and liver failure. He succumbed because he presented to the health facilities too late.
The yellow fever virus is transmitted by an infected mosquito and found in tropical regions of Africa and Latin America. Symptoms of the yellow fever include a headache, vomiting and fatigue. Statistics from Angolan health officials show that more than 50 people have recently died of the virus and 250 were infected. The Angolan government has vaccinated 500,000 people against this virus and health officials are targeting another million. Kioko says Kenya is on high alert at its entry points.
So we have sent an alert notice to all our health workers, all hospitals, public and private, to ensure that they are on high alert and having a high index of suspicion. All people who have traveled from the high-risk countries where Ebola has never been reported, we put them on the list of suspicion and we are able to investigate them thoroughly.
There is no specific treatment for yellow fever. In serious cases, patients are admitted to a hospital where staff provide supportive care, such as pain relievers and intravenous fluids to ward off dehydration. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Ugandan parliament voted unanimously this month in favor of a new law that makes it harder for foreigners to adopt children and take them out of the country. Proponents say the new law closes loopholes exploited by child traffickers, while critics say it may rob needy children of the chance at a better life overseas. Sergino Rusblad has more from Kampala.
Ugandan lawmakers say the old adoption law allowed foreigners to quickly obtain legal guardianship of a child so they could then take them out of the country and finalize the adoption abroad. This new law, passed March 2nd, restricts guardianship of orphaned or needy children to Ugandan nationals. Parliament member Bernard Atiku initiated the bill.
The current law was made way back. It has been many years since it was enacted. And as we talk, there are many new forms of child exploitation that have emerged. There are many challenges in as far as the rights of the children is concerned that have emerged. And other forms of abuse. So the current situation needed an amendment.
Inter-country adoption from Uganda has boomed in recent years. About 200 children are adopted annually, according to Ugandan Child Rights NGO Network. Many of them are adopted by American families. But Stella Ayo Odongo of the Child Rights Group say more children are disappearing.
In 2012, the other statistics from the African Child Policy Forum indicate that 680 children left the country. Now, the only ones that we could account for as having gone through the adoption process at 227. So what happened to the other 400 and so many? It's difficult to tell.
She says even for children adopted by well-intended parents, there have been no follow-up mechanisms to see where children end up and whether they are properly cared for. Child traffickers operating in the region are believed to be targeting needy children for domestic work, labor in mines, or even ritual sacrifice. Uganda's new law does not ban foreign adoption, but it does enforce a longer waiting period, something experts say is important. The adoptive parents and child need time to get acquainted and create a bond. The new law requires foreign adoptive parents to stay at least 1 year in Uganda. Ellie Hamill of Carolina Adoption Services in the U.S. says this might not be realistic.
I think it's fair and very appropriate for families to have to spend a good period of time in country because it's important that they get to know their child's culture and really embrace it and learn as much as they can about the history. But 1 year just is, unfortunately, is not realistic for the majority of families to have to stay here consistently. Perhaps they have other children at home, they have work, so that way they can continue to provide for their families.
Some people say it's in the child's best interest to get him or her out of an orphanage as soon as possible by allowing a foreign adoptive parents to assume guardianship. But Odongo of the Child Rights NGO disagrees.
What has been happening is that no effort was being made to identify the legal guardians. All the cases that would come up in the home, in the care institutions would be up for adoption even without an attempt of trying to trace the parents and reunite them and foster them even within the country. So I don't agree with the assertion.
The new law also creates a government agency to take care of orphaned and needy children. Child rights activists are calling for a temporary moratorium on inter-country adoptions until the new law is implemented and new monitoring authorities and procedures are put in place. President Yoweri Museveni is expected to sign the law in the next 2 months. Other African countries like Ethiopia have also recently tightened their foreign adoption rules. Kenya banned foreign adoption in 2014. Serginho Rosblat for VOA News, Kampala.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
And we're delivering more sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Starting March 21st, the Sunny Side of Sports is expanding to half an hour. Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Tune in starting Monday, March 21st. right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Five Egyptian soldiers are reported dead and 10 others injured after explosions at a weapons depot in the northern Sinai. Kenya's military has killed 19 al-Shabaab militants in Afmado, the second largest city in southern Somalia. Ghana's government puts the nation on high alert in the wake of Sunday's deadly terror attack in neighboring Ivory Coast. Coming up, we have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, taxi driving serves as a gateway job for tens of thousands of immigrants in New York City. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning with a soccer player from Sierra Leone.
Kim, the Sunny Side of Sports spotlight is shining this evening on Kai Kamara, the striker for Sierra Leone and the Columbus Crew in Major League Soccer. The 31-year-old Kamara is coming off the most productive season of his MLS career. He was the league's joint leading scorer with 22 goals during the regular season. And with four goals, Kamara was the top goal scorer in the 2015 MLS playoffs. Columbus reached the MLS Cup final before falling at home to the Portland Timbers 2-1. VOA's Rick Narcisse reached Kai Kamara after a Columbus training session and asked him, how do you plan to top your 2015 season?
Just be focused. It's a very important year when you have a season like we did as a team, and also me individually. It's really good, but then always just coming back from that and continue to doing almost the same thing or better than you did. So it's really being focused, and for me, just to have the same connection as I did last year with my teammates and just continue to work hard, because it's a really good time in my career right now that I need to continue being at my best.
How important is winning the MLS Cup to you?
Winning the MLS Cup is all I play for right now. Obviously, earlier in my career, you know, I enjoy the game. I want to play. I want to score goals. But right now, my focus is just winning the cup. I've been in this league for 10 years playing. I really miss a cup in a few different teams that I've played for. So definitely right now, if I can win the MLS Cup, it's really all that I'm playing for.
What did you try to focus on this offseason to be better this year?
The offseason was all about resting a little bit, because our season was longer than everybody else's. We went all the way to December, while most of the teams finished in October. And so it was just getting a little bit of rest, refreshed my buttons, went back home to Sierra Leone, see my family, and celebrate the end of Ebola with them, and just have a little bit of, you know, joyful time with them. And then I came back into preseason.
Who are some of the players this season that you're really looking forward to playing?
I would have to say I'm looking forward to playing against a lot of teams, really, because it's a very competitive league this year. It's always been, you know, in the past few years. So we're looking forward to challenging a lot of teams, because a lot of teams want to play against us, and a lot of teams know, you know, we play one of the beautiful, you know, soccer and competitive soccer in America. But yeah, at the same time, yeah, there's big names of players in this league now, as the Didier Drogba, Frank Lampard, Jovinko, David Villa, and all those names. I mean, yeah, you can say you look forward to play against them, but to me, really, I just look forward to playing against all the different teams.
So last year, you won the MLS Works Humanitarian of the Year Award. So what did that mean to you?
It's an honor to be recognized as a humanitarian. You know, to me, it's not a job. I'm just being myself, helping out here in America and helping out in Sierra Leone, or just helping out even when I work with Right to Play, when I, you know, we travel to places like Liberia, Peru, and just different countries. You know, it's part of me, and I'm really happy when I'm involved into doing these things. I don't feel like it's a job. So, but definitely to be honored as a Humanitarian of the Year last year, it shows like a little bit of respect, saying, you know, we appreciate what you do. I'm not going to stop doing it, and I'm not going to keep doing it just to win awards. I'm just doing it because that's just part of me, and that's, you know, it makes me feel good.
So what would you say is your greatest achievement as a player?
It's really out there. It's really random. For soccer, definitely, you know, greatest achievement has to be, you know, just becoming a professional soccer player. You know, I came into America at the age of 16. I said to myself, by the age of 19, I wanted to go to college, which I did. And then by the age of 21, I want to play professional soccer, which I did. So all those are just, you know, really, really good achievement. And obviously then later on making another goal for myself saying I want to play in England, which I did, playing for Norwich. And so it's amazing. But achievement in life, I have to, you know, say right now, it's you know, having my little girl, you know, having the child last year was definitely one of the greatest achievements I've had.
How did that change your life? Did that change your perspective on things a little bit, having your first child?
It does. It's a beautiful thing. Obviously, growing up in Africa, we all know all our families are really big, you know, having extended family or just, you know, near family. But definitely when you have your child of your own, everything changes, you know, become humble to it. And for me, it's a girl. So they say when you have a girl, you treat her like a princess. And that's what I'm doing. And she gets the best part of me, you know, the soft side of me. It's good too on the field. Off the field, because it keeps me grounded. It keeps me more rest, you know, off the field, because I'm home most of the time and spending time with her. And so when I'm ready to get back on the field, then I'm always ready.
Arguably, you have some of the best goal celebrations in the league.
Thank you.
How do you come up with these celebrations?
Oh man, it's part of my personality. I love to dance. I love to have fun. I love to connect with my teammates. So it's just definitely part of my personality. I watch soccer all around the world, you know, and my celebration is not just soccer related. It's just about just life, you know, music. I'm, you know, listen to music and all the musicians out there and what they do, what they dance and all that. So when I'm on the field, you know, I try to implement that. But before I could, you know, celebrate, you know, I have to score a goal. And obviously most of my celebrations, I try to involve some of my teammates in it, because maybe not a lot of people are that creative as me, but, you know, if I can involve them into it, it really does help and brings the team chemistry together.
So do you watch any NCAA basketball?
NCAA basketball, no, I'm not a big fan. I went to a small school in California, Division II, so we never made, you know, the bracket or, you know, the big ones. But a lot of my teammates are into it, but not me. But if I have to support a team right now, I have to say it's have to be KU, Kansas basketball team.
What's funny is Monmouth, their bench, has some of the best celebrations. It's been all over ESPN.
I'll have to look them up and some of their celebrations.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to us today. Good luck on everything. I see you already got one goal, so hopefully you can lead the league again and top last year and keep getting better and maybe winning a championship.
Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate you. Thanks for having me. And, yeah, God bless. Hopefully we talk again soon.
That's Kai Kamara, the striker for Sierra Leone and the Columbus Crew in Major League Soccer. And Kai was talking with VOA's Rick Narcisse by telephone from Columbus, Ohio. Meanwhile, Rick is also guest blogger this week at the Sunny Side of Sports blog. The address is blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Rick writes about Malian player Sheck Jalo of the University of Kansas, which is the number one overall seed in the annual National Collegiate Athletic Association Division I Men's Basketball Championship Tournament. Turning to athletics, the 16th IAAF World Indoor Championships officially open later Thursday night in the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon. I asked track analyst Parker Pick Up the Pace Morse about the venue in Portland.
They have made a custom track for this event, which is in the Oregon Convention Center. Before they moved into the convention center, they actually set up the track in a vacant warehouse in downtown Portland to try it out and make sure everything fit together. And for a couple of weeks, they opened the track up to the general public, workout groups, high school kids. They had it all ready to go in this abandoned warehouse. There are actually pillars in the infield of the track because of the warehouse, and there are some interesting pictures of the pillars are marked for forklifts with signs that say speed limit 5 miles per hour.
And Parker, I know a few of the African athletes will definitely exceed that speed limit. Can you spotlight a few of the Africans who we should be watching in Portland?
There are three big races, and of course, with the dominance of Kenya and Ethiopia in the distance races, the men's and women's 3,000 meters are both going to be very interesting races. In particular, the men's 3,000 meters is going to be another matchup of that classic long-running rivalry between Kenya and Ethiopia. Kenya has put up the defending champion, Augustine Chogi, Isaiah Koech, and Caleb Ndiku. Caleb Ndiku is probably the only entrant with his own rap theme. if you look on YouTube, you can find Run Caleb Ndiku. And Ethiopia has two entrants, Dejan Gebremeskel, who had a pretty hot 3,000 in Boston a couple of weeks ago. Yomif Kejelcha won the World Junior Championships 2 years ago, just down the road from Portland in Eugene. In the women's 3,000, Genzebe Dibaba has been on a world record tear for several years. It's hard to find a way that somebody can beat her. She has the finishing speed to outkick just about anybody. On the other hand, Ethiopia has also entered Meseret Defar, who is back on the track after several years away. Defar won the women's 3,000 at World Indoors four times. And Kenya has Betsy Saina and Nancy Chepkwemoy entered in that race. Finally, the men's 1,500 meters has all three medalists from 2014 returning. Ayanle Suleiman from Djibouti, Aman Wolte from Ethiopia, and Abdulwadi Igwider from Morocco. It is possible that Igwider will run the 3,000 instead of the 1,500. Also, Bethwell Bergen of Kenya in that race, a very deep race and could go any number of ways.
Thanks, Parker. That's track analyst Parker Pick Up the Pace Morse, who's covering the IAAF World Indoor Championships in Athletics in Portland, Oregon. And we'll hear more from Parker on Friday's show. Joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is Andrew Palcheski, the voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sunny. Good to be with you.
What's trending in the sports world on this Thursday?
Hashtag family first. Now, this isn't necessarily something you'd think about as a sports trending hashtag, but it is trending in the sports world because of baseball player Adam LaRoche. Now, LaRoche plays for the Chicago White Sox.
And he used to play right here in Washington.
And used to play right here in Washington, D.C. for the Nationals. And over the course of spring training, as his team's been kind of warming up for the start of the baseball season, he's had his son, Drake, in the clubhouse with the team.
Okay.
Apparently, this was an issue. Something arose where the team's general manager or president told him, you can't have your son here every day. This isn't a daycare center. So LaRoche went, and he was owed $13 million in this year that he was about to play for the Chicago White Sox, and he up and quit and said, I'm done. I'm walking away from $13 million if my son can't be with me here as I do my job. And he tweeted this out with hashtag family first.
Incredible. I really believe, Andrew, there must be more to that story when you're walking away from that kind of money.
There must be something that we're in. I'm sure that we're going to hear more about this. But for right now, what we're seeing is this hashtag family first trending. We had Bryce Harper, who is a star MLB young player, plays for the Nationals, played with Adam LaRoche on the Nationals. He tweeted out and said, great job, good for you. It's a family game. A lot of people coming to Adam LaRoche's support here. And the Chicago White Sox are going to have to do a bit of damage control, it looks like, on social media. They're saying now, well, he was there too much. It's not that we don't want children of players in the clubhouse. It's that he was there every day. So there's a lot of kind of back and forth.
And I did read one quote from a Chicago team official, and I sort of agreed with him. He said, well, let's face it, at most offices, you're not allowed to bring your child every day to the workplace.
And that's what the Chicago White Sox are saying, and a lot of the people on social media are saying, well, maybe he was bringing him too much. But by and large, there's a lot of support for Adam LaRoche. It's people saying it's a very gutsy move, very courageous move to put your family ahead of $13 million. Maybe a little, you know, a silly move perhaps, but it's nice that he can walk away from that and afford to walk away from that. But certainly there's going to hear more about that.
Well, now, Andrew, Adam LaRoche has more time to watch March Madness.
Absolutely. It's a great segue there. He has more time to watch March Madness because it kicked off today. The 64 teams that are participating in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. And I found something interesting from this company, Blue Fountain Media. And what they did was they looked at which teams they predict to win based on their social media following. So they took their Facebook likes, comments, and shares, their Instagram likes and comments, their Twitter likes and retweets, and divided those numbers by the number of followers for each of those social media. And they determined what their audience engagement score was for each of the 64 schools that are in the tournament.
So it's kind of based on activity, how active you are on social
media. Right, and how
media.
Well those schools can engage with their audiences. So they fill out a bracket based on that, and they have, I'm sorry to say, hey, it's not Michigan winning. They have Duke, the overall winner. They
Duke
say,
again? Duke?
Duke again. Duke. They say that Duke is the best at engaging their audience, engaging
what
their social media followers. So we'll see if this holds out, but they said that this could be a guide for people to fill out their brackets. Well, incidentally, Duke is actually playing right now as we speak against UNC Wilmington. So that game is kicking off the start of the tournament.
An all-North Carolina matchup.
An all-North Carolina matchup. So we'll see if Duke can repeat as national champions. They're going to have a lot of hurdles in their way. But as far as social media is concerned, Duke is the champion.
And who's the final four in terms of social media, Andrew?
Well, they have Kansas, who's the overall number one, facing off against Duke on one side of the bracket. The other side, they have Kentucky and Michigan State. So those four schools are the top four in engaging their audiences on social media.
Interesting. Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thanks for joining us again, Andrew.
Thank you.
And I'll see you on Friday. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, taxi driving serves as a gateway job for tens of thousands of immigrants in New York City. But first, some music. Here is Osibisa from Ghana with Ojoye. Jay! Jay! Ojoye! Ghana's Osibisa with Ojaye.
In New York City, taxi driving serves as a gateway job for tens of thousands of immigrants, including those who have come from Africa. In all, there are 175 nations represented in New York's taxi industry. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Mira Joshi, chairman of the city's Taxi and Limousine Commission that licenses and regulates the industry. She began by describing the size and scope of the industry.
We license about 150,000 drivers. That's 90,000 vehicles that they drive, transporting about 1 million passengers a day, and in taxi alone, about 400,000 a day.
It's one of the most New York jobs you can get, isn't it?
Absolutely. You'll meet every New Yorker driving a for-hire vehicle.
It's not really traditionally an American, born in America kind of job anymore. I noticed there are a lot of foreign-born drivers. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about New York and immigrants and the taxi industry.
It's definitely not an American-born job. Our largest group of drivers are from Bangladesh. We have a large Hispanic group of drivers and a large group of African drivers as well. So it's definitely a pathway for many immigrants that come to America. The licensing requirements are basically that you have a driver's license, a clean record, and there's flexibility allowed. So you can work different hours, and that works for a lot of immigrants that may either have other jobs or pursuing education initiatives. We have a sort of a knowledge test, but you do about 24 hours worth of training to help you get to a position where you can take that test. And I think a lot of drivers find that knowing those things makes them better drivers and gets them better tips, so they pick up on all that stuff pretty quickly.
I guess it's also a way of sort of integrating them into the mainstream, not just economically, but culturally.
Yeah, I kind of think there's sort of transferable skills. So learning customer service, whether you're going to be a driver or anything else, is probably useful. And learning how to negotiate your way around New York legally is also very useful as well.
So let's talk a little bit about the African case. You mentioned these different sort of large ethnic groups.
The African community we have in green taxis, yellow taxis, as well as our black car and livery sector. So there's a good percentage in every sector.
What are the differences between those three different kinds of cabs?
The green and the yellow have a metered fare, and you can stick your hand up in the air and get one of them. And the black car and the livery pay whatever price that has been arranged upon between the dispatcher and the customer, and you can only get them by making an arrangement ahead of time to get them or through now an app.
In my experience, it's very often the case that African drivers are in the green cabs. They actually service the boroughs where a lot of immigrant communities are. Is there any correlation between the kind of cab they drive and sort of where they're from?
A lot of livery drivers, when the green taxis came into being, painted their livery cars and they became green taxis. So a lot of the African community that was already working in the livery sector just transformed to green taxi drivers, which is what we wanted because they were doing some hail work anyway, and we wanted to give them an opportunity to make that legal.
Do you have anything more to say about the particulars of the African drivers in terms of whether they're from East Africa, West Africa, or French-speaking, et cetera?
I don't know the particulars of the regions, but I do have to commend them for really coming together and forming drivers groups that are vocal and that come to the TLC and make their opinions known, and that's extremely important for us when we make policy. They were very vocal about protection for drivers. Unfortunately, in 2014, we had two horrendous carjackings where African drivers were victims and died, and in the wake of that, they were extremely vocal and key to meetings that were held with NYPD as well as the mayor's office on how to have better support for drivers in the field.
And how did that come down?
Basically, it was NYPD agreeing that there needs to be a specific liaison for the African driving community as well as the rest of the driving community, and so they didn't feel so disenfranchised from NYPD.
That was Commissioner Mira Joshi of the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The strength of a nation depends on the success of all of its people. So any country hoping to grow and flourish must recognize the important contributions of women from all backgrounds and enable them to succeed in their work. Latin America has come a long way over the past two decades. Women serve in elected office, including as heads of state. They run businesses, large and small. They study and they teach. Yet they still face many obstacles. Perhaps most appalling is the widespread violence against women in the Americas, said U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Noting that between 17% and 53% of all women in Latin America have been victims of physical or sexual violence inflicted by their partners, Undersecretary Sewell said that many Latin American countries rank among the worst in the world for the number of women killed each year. To prevent violence against women, we must address imbalances in education, employment, and politics that reinforce a culture where women are valued less than men, where they are somehow seen as less worthy of equal respect, opportunity, and protection. Women who have suffered violence must have a clear pathway to justice, a system that consistently enforces the law and ensures a fair and responsive judicial process. The U.S. government works to prevent and respond to violence against women, integrate a gender perspective into our work, especially to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. In 2012, the United States developed a global strategy to tackle all forms of gender-based violence, which affects all countries around the world, including the United States. In Latin America, we assist indigenous and African descendant women to participate in local government and advocate against violence and discrimination. We train women entrepreneurs to reach new markets, and we partner with local law enforcement to train more female police officers, prosecutors, and judges. We do this not only because gender equality is inherently worthwhile, said Undersecretary Sewell. When you broaden participation and emphasize inclusion, in business, in arts and culture, in politics, it enriches us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
VOA Africa has more of what you love, an expanded Sunny Side of Sports show, more on-the-scene reports and analysis, plus what's trending in the sports world. Come to VOA Africa for the expanded half hour of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Remember, tune in starting Monday, March 21st, right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.